This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's new movies include Dunkirk, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, Girls Trip, and Maudie. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup featuring Kong Skull Island. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
We had two pretty major film deaths in the last week. The first one happened all the way back at last weekend's, and that was George Romero. And he died at 77 after a battle with lung cancer. It came really as a surprise, and mainly because he has always been very active in the fan community. I've known people who've booked him at things, and he was always apparently just a total gentleman about these sort of things. And I mean, aside from like Bill Paxton when he passed away several months ago, and nobody expected that, this was kind of a surprise to me, even though he was 77. And it's sad because you want to talk about somebody who, boy, left an indelible mark. That was George Romero. I mean, how many people can lay claim to essentially creating an entire breed of monster? Sure, flesh-eating zombies existed in other forms before, but it was really George Romero with Night of the Living Dead in 1968 that created the zombie culture. And without that, you wouldn't have gotten shows like The Walking Dead. You wouldn't have gotten other classic movies, other series that have gone on to have multiple sequels themselves, like Return of the Living Dead. Anything with Living Dead in it. If you didn't have George Romero, you didn't have that. And while other people could have created it, no one did. And it took until 1968 to really make that happen. In fact, I mean, talk about somebody who changed the culture of horror movies, went from zombies being the white zombie version from the old white zombie movie, which were voodoo zombies, people who have been sort of, their mind has been taken over or raised from the dead, but not really, just sort of an enslaved person to the actual living dead. And that was George Romero's legacy. For better or for worse, I think in some ways he tried to escape it, like anyone has. Like when Leonard Nimoy, there was a period of time where he was retreating from Spock and then he embraced it. And I think George Romero was the same way. Now, in terms for me, I'm not a huge fan of all the Dead movies. I thought the first three were really good. My favorite's Night of the Living Dead. And then Dawn of the Dead is so monumental because it really has subtext to it. But it was still a big, epic zombie movie. But it's the other stuff he did, stuff like The Crazies, which is a viscerally terrifying movie. And if you haven't seen it, it's worth checking out. Or Creepshow. Creepshow is actually my favorite of George Romero's movies because he takes Stephen King's stories, which are very, at the time, very contemporary and relevant, and made them into an homage to EC horror comics, and that was wonderful. So, yeah, George Romero is going to be missed. Another celebrity death that happened was Martin Landau. Again, he was 89. I mean, he was way up there, but this was unexpected. He died of unexpected complications after a hospital stay. Martin Landau has also left an indelible mark on movies and television. And that's interesting to note because it used to be that you were either a TV actor or a movie actor. You had to choose. And Martin Landau did both at a time that people generally didn't do both. I'm talking, sometimes you'd have celebrities who are in movies and they do guest spots on television. But Martin Landau was a working actor in TV. He showed up on a lot of things. I'm not just talking about Mission Impossible or Space 1999. I mean, he showed up on all these different shows. He was a TV actor, but he was also a movie actor. He won an Academy Award. The most powerful performance I remember seeing of his was in Ed Wood as Bela Lugosi. usually it was poison. If you were a movie actor and you went back and did TV, it was considered a career killer. But Martin Landau did both. And on top of it, he's doing it. He was in a movie I saw just not too long ago called Remember, which I thought was a fantastic film. Now, of course, he always, as he got older, he played older men. He played geriatric characters. And in the movie Remember, he was a man in a nursing home in a wheelchair. But boy, he was working up until the bitter end. He defined near a century of entertainment. If you've been alive in the last 60 years, you know who he is just by watching TV and movies. And the only way you wouldn't know is if you've never seen a TV show or movie. So Martin Landau is one of those classic actors who will always go down and be remembered. So yeah, it's sad. I hate having new segments where I have to eulogize two greats in the industry, and that happened this week, George Romero and Martin Landau. Sad to see them both go, and very relevant to check out some of their work. Everything from George Romero with the Dead movies up to Creepshow and the Crazies, and Martin Landau with everything from Mission Impossible to Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood and Space 1999 and more contemporary stuff where you just see him showing up. So, yeah, it's a sad week in Hollywood. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That's on me. It's time to roll the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is The Snowman, which opens on October 20th, starring Michael Fassbender and Rebecca Ferguson tracking down a serial killer.
A woman vanished last night. We just found the body.
Prints?
And the head. He's missing. He calls himself the Snowman Killer. He's completely insane.
One of the things that I find most intriguing about this movie is it's this sort of Nordic story. It takes place in the north, snowy. I love those movies. I'd love to live up there. You know, you see these movies where everyone's all depressed because they live in Norway and there's 24 hours of darkness versus 24 hours of sun going back and forth. You see movies like Insomnia or TV shows like Lilyhammer and they portray Norway as being beautiful but ultimately soul crushing at times. I think it looks awesome. My wife would never live up there. She likes the warm weather way too much. I love the cold weather. It kind of has, in a lot of ways, it has a feel of, even though it's not a horror, I mean, it's not a horror story with a traditional monster or a vampire story, but it feels a bit like Let the Right One In, where you have the oppressive cold and the starkness and the lifelessness of beauty hiding frozen bitterness. I mean, this looks like a good movie. I'm looking forward to it. A good old-fashioned serial killer movie. Hopefully it's better than something like Girl on the Train, which had a lot of hope, in my opinion, but then just sort of didn't quite deliver. The next one I want to talk about is A Wrinkle in Time, which opens on March 9th.
Your father has accomplished something extraordinary. Also dangerous. He's trapped by a darkness that's actively spreading throughout the universe. And the only one who can stop it is you. Be a warrior.
I'll try.
This is based on Madeline L'Engle's book, obviously, and it's directed by Ava DuVernay. And I'm interested in seeing it to see what she does with it, just a regular run-of-the-mill movie. You know, it's a lot of times when you have a director she's so steeped in the cultural aspect of things, especially coming on really strong with Selma, which was a fantastic movie, to just do a regular old mainstream movie to see what we end up with. And I'm curious to see what she does with just that. I mean, it would have been neat to see what she would have done with the superhero movies that she'd been offered. But now she's doing big budget Disney special effect driven movie. It's been so long since I've read Wrinkle in Time. I must have been in like third grade when I read it. So I don't even remember much about it aside from like the three witches. And it was a time travel movie. So I'm curious to see what it is. I don't even want to go refresh my memory of what the story was because I kind of want to go in fresh. This looks like high concept Disney. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets and Maudie. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews, and we're going to kick it off with Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Luc Besson adapts a graphic novel about two military officers tasked with finding a kidnapped general in a space station that is home to hundreds of aliens and cultures.
Welcome to Alpha, the City of a Thousand Planets. After centuries of peace and prosperity, an unknown force wants to destroy all we have created.
Agents Valerian and Laureline, you have less than 10 hours to find the threat and eliminate it.
Let's get to work.
It's funny, I have a love-hate relationship with Luc Besson. I actually interviewed him about 10 years ago when he came out with Arthur and the Invisibles. And I mean, he's a very charming man. It's so funny because I don't like everything that Luc Besson has done. Some of his movies I thought have been fantastic, and some of them really have bridged that international gap, like Lucy or Taken. Those are movies that did well internationally, but also did well domestically here. But a lot of his movies are French. I mean, he's French, and it has a more European feel to him, which is why you get movies like The Fifth Element that did so-so here in America, but did extremely well overseas. He did, of course, the original La Femme Nikita. He does a variety of movies, and you cannot discount the fact that this is a rabid movie fan. This is a guy who just doesn't make movies. He loves making movies, but he loves watching movies, and he loves the excitement of doing it. And there's a certain sense of wonder he brings here to all of his movies, and he does that with Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. So there's a lot of respect I have for Luc Besson. Now, with that said, this movie has some problems. In some ways, it really feels derivative of other films. There's parts of it that look like it's taken right out of Avatar in terms of the characters and their look and their design. And there's other parts that seem very derivative of Star Wars. There's like literally a scene where they go through a trash compactor shoot. Also, the lead characters, Valerian and Laureline, Dane DeHaan, who does this weird Keanu Reeves impression through the movie. You've seen him before in movies. He played the Green Goblin in the Amazing Spider-Man films, and he did Chronicle. And then Cara Delevingne, who was in movies like Paper Towns and more recently in Suicide Squad, she played the Enchantress in that. They really don't have good chemistry. They really try. They try to give them character and chemistry moments, but it just doesn't quite work. They do kind of fall flat, and they're very, they don't do a great job acting in this. On top of it, there's also scenes that just seem bizarre and out there and contradictory to the story itself, where they say, we can't do this one thing, and then they go and they do that to an extreme degree. And there's moments of comedy. There's like this weird diversion where they have Rihanna in this bizarre role. So it really has these strange moments that don't quite work. But on the same token, this is a gorgeous movie. I mean, this movie is kind of a sight to behold. This is the kind of movie that I don't particularly like the story, and I don't necessarily like the characters, but I could put it on the background and just enjoy the heck out of it. Sort of like Lost in Space, if you remember when they made that movie like 20 years ago. That movie's a neat movie to have in the background because it has some great imagery and visuals and action. This one has it as well, and it sort of spins, it's sort of this weird mix of Guardians of the Galaxy and the Fifth Element styles to it, where some of it's really weird and extreme, but also it's very colorful and vibrant. The action's great. This is very much a big screen movie to see. And there's parts of it that I absolutely love, but it's not a cohesive film. And that's a shame because I love seeing something different. And it's so sad when there's a movie, and I know this isn't going to do well in America, but I think it's also made much for a global marketplace. And don't give me, honestly, mark my words, in a couple of weeks, you're going to start seeing articles written about online about, Valerian and the City of the Thousand Planets is a big bomb. But when you look at the final box office globally, because it's got Chinese money in it and it's done by a French director about a French graphic novel, it's very European and very French. In terms of its of sort of its approach, I think it's going to do very well overseas, and it'll be a profitable movie, just like Arthur and the Invisibles, just like The Fifth Element, just like some of his other movies that haven't quite clicked in America. So, you know, I've had a couple days to think about this movie, and I'm going to give it a kind of rocks very trepidatiously because it was right there on the tipping point, but I'm giving it a kind of rocks because. It was at least interesting, and I wouldn't mind sitting through it again.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Maudie. The life and marriage of Nova Scotia folk artist Maud Lewis is examined in this low-key biopic.
Let me tell you how it is around here.
There's me, them dogs, them chickens, then you.
You want me here, don't you? Because I'll walk out right now.
Told you could paint fairies on the wall.
I think it looks all right.
I'd like to see one of your larger paintings.
$5.
Done.
Her paintings have even been sold to Vice President Nixon.
You can find Maud Lewis selling her paintings from the front steps of her little house here in Marshalltown, Nova Scotia.
The biggest reason to see this movie is because of Sally Hawkins. I love Sally Hawkins. She got a lot of notice for the movie. I think it was Happy Go Lucky that came out 7 or 8 years ago. And she's done a lot of great stuff. Now, the thing is, she doesn't click necessarily in America because she's older. She's in her 40s, I think. You know, but she's an older actress. She's not this 20-something starlet, but she is a fantastic actress. And she doesn't always get the best part. She's in the Paddington movies as the mom. And she's charming as all get out in that. And I saw her in this actually quite excellent short film that was nominated for an Academy Award about suicide prevention a couple of years ago. But Sally Hawkins is fantastic as Maudie. She really sort of takes the character and makes it her own. And the character is very sort of morose but has a certain charm and cheerfulness in her core. And it's about her and her husband. And her husband's a big poop. Let's just put it that way. You look at him, he's a big grumpy guy who had a little farmhouse and they had this weird relationship that ended up turning into a romance that turned into a marriage. And they kind of then circled the wagons around each other, even though they kind of had it be adversarial. Ethan Hawke plays her husband. And it's oddly enough, he's also in Valerian. So he gets two movies this weekend. But I wouldn't say Maudie was a great movie. It's a performance film, not necessarily for Ethan Hawke. He does seem to kind of play a very easy stock role. Not the one that he's played a lot before, but just we've seen it before. But really, it's Sally Hawkins is the reason to see this. If you like Sally Hawkins, if you know anything about Maud Lewis, who was a painter, and the whole thing is she started painting the house. I mean, like, not like a house painter, but started painting her art on the house. And she did these little postcards, and then she did larger pieces of art. And she became this phenomenon. But she's like having like flowers and trees and animals and all this stuff painted on her house on the inside and out, and that's kind of become its own little art installation itself. You can still go see the house, which is kind of neat. It's sort of this little claim to fame from Nova Scotia. But being Nova Scotia, it is kind of desolate and cold, and at times, I mean, they go through the seasons because it takes place over years, but it really shows the limited scope of Maud Lewis's life, but it also shows what her talent was. And in that sense, like I said, there's a lot of movies that are really just sort of spotlight pieces. And this is a spotlight piece for Sally Hawkins. And it's great to see her getting a movie she can really dive into. And she does a fine job in it. So I'm going to have to say Maudie kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dunkirk and Girls Trip.
Stop it now.
Stop. there is something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's hit the big movie, the Christopher Nolan film. This is the one that's going to save the summer. I am kind of making fun of the hype because Christopher Nolan has quickly turned into one of those directors that his fans don't even have to see the movie and they love it. It's very similar to the fans, and I'm going to make a lot of comparisons from Dunkirk to Transformers and between Christopher Nolan and Michael Bay. I know that's insulting to some people, but I don't care. In a lot of ways, Christopher Nolan fans are like Michael Bay fans. They will defend his movies before they even see it. I saw Dunkirk and I wrote a negative review of it. And I put it up. I got it linked off of Rotten Tomatoes because I can do that. And I haven't written a full review in a while, but that's one that I figured, well, that's good because we'll see what people say about this. And it got a lot of traffic and a lot of hate for that. It's amazing how many people attacked me having not seen the movie. And that's the kind of director Christopher Nolan is. And you get that with Michael Bay fans. Michael Bay fans just know they're going to like his movies, whether they're not, and any fan of any director, but pretty much people knew they were going to like, you know, fans of Transformers didn't care that Transformers was terrible, this latest one. They just liked it because it was Michael Bay, and they'd be mad at you if you were attacking him. Dunkirk is his attempt to do a war film. And it's also his first time he stepped out of fantastic elements since, I think, Insomnia, which was early 2000s? I mean, because all the Dark Knight movies and Interstellar and Inception all kind of had these science fiction bits to it. I mean, yeah, Interstellar was meant to be realistic, kind of, but it was still a visionary in the future type movie. Dunkirk takes place in 1940, and it's a real story about 400,000 troops, British troops, that are stuck in Dunkirk as the Nazis are pushing them, trying to get through the city to kill them. And they can't evacuate because the Luftwaffe will come in and just blow up any ship trying to get them off the beach, and it's blowing up the people on the beach, and they're just sort of sitting ducks there. It's a story of how on the beach they're trying to survive, and then from the sea they're sending civilian vessels over, and of course you got very few from the Royal Air Force that are actually able to protect the beach, and it shows the chaos. It doesn't give you much context of anything, because I think deliberately Nolan is saying, oh, this is what it was like as a soldier on the ground. You didn't know what was going on, you didn't know what was happening back home, you didn't know what the plan was, you just wanted to get on a boat and get the heck out of there.
We've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk!
I'm not going back. If we go, they will die.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home!
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
For what Nolan does, he does exceptionally well. I mean, it is a powerful movie. It is an intense movie. There's great special effects. The action's fantastic. The visuals are amazing. Everyone says, oh, see it at 70mm IMAX. I saw it in DCP, but I'm sure 70mm is pretty impressive for just the imagery. It shows how difficult it was to shoot down planes from another plane at the time. And, I mean, the war action elements to it are fantastic. With that said, all these people out there saying it's the greatest movie of the year, it's the greatest war movie ever made, you're flat out wrong. And I will tell you why. This is half of a movie. It's a great half of a movie, but it is still half a movie. It is the end of a film. It's like walking into Titanic when they hit the iceberg. The first half of that movie, you have all the character and the context and the history and the development. And then from the point they hit the iceberg, it's wrapping everything up and everybody reacting. This one gives you none of that. It gives you no story, character, context, history, or even development. The closest you get to any sort of character development and emotional resonance is a character played by Mark Rylance, who's one of the civilian pleasure boat drivers who goes and tries to evacuate people from Dunkirk. And that's more just because Mark Rylance is so good at delivering that. And I've had people complain and say, well, you know, Nolan doesn't spoon feed you the emotion. Yeah, but every bit of emotion you got to bring there, you got to project everything onto those characters. I don't expect to be spoon-fed, but at least put it on the plate. As much as I had issue with the characters in Valerian, at least they attempted to do it. Nolan has been taken to the task for being an emotionless, joyless, soulless director. That was no more apparent than if you watched Interstellar, where he had tons of emotion, but it all was flat because he didn't know how to deliver it. He didn't know how to package it. And that's why I felt nothing when I saw Interstellar, and I felt even less when I watched this. They're tin soldiers. You don't get the humanity in war. And that's the real tragedy of war. That's the war is hell mentality. Yeah, it's dangerous and it's crazy, but they're cardboard cutouts. This is not a full movie. And it feels in some ways as if Nolan's sort of responding to his critics saying, well, you don't like my long movies. Okay, I'm going to do a short one. Oh, you don't like my failures at emotional context? I'm just not going to put any in there. You know, you don't think I do enough dialogue that makes sense that you got to hear? Yeah, I'm not going to put that in there either. I mean, you got Tom Hardy once again through another Christopher Nolan movie with a mask on his face. So the whole freaking thing at the very end, you see him without his mask on, but he's a fighter pilot. You can't understand a freaking word this guy says. It's almost become a caricature of Christopher Nolan movies. And that's why I say this is a huge achievement, but it's also a colossal failure because it's Nolan stubbornly not giving you what you need in a movie. And you can't say, well, it's deliberate, but he just wanted to do it. He didn't want to show the characters and he didn't want to show what's going on back home. And he didn't want to show what the plan was because that's cliche. It's like, maybe it is, but that's how movies are made. Otherwise you get a $150 million experimental film. This movie has as much emotional resonance as Transformers 5 does, and that's a garbage movie. But I would even say that at least Michael Bay tries. He puts characters in there. They're absolute garbage, but at least he tries. This is a fine example of people overhyping a movie. Do not believe the hype for Dunkirk. It is not the best war film. It's not even the best film of the year. It's not the best film of the summer, that's even. It's incredibly, colossally disappointing. And that's sad because I think Nolan could do better. So I don't know. I mean, at the very end, Dunkirk is okay, but it's half a movie. So it gets half of my rating. And I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about Girls Trip. Four women who have been friends since college go on a raucous trip.
This weekend is about us. We deserve this. So let's go.
We need to talk.
There ain't nothing you need to say to her that you can't say in front of us.
Today is the last day that we will ever be this young.
I have not had this much fun in so long.
This one was screened. Now, there are movies I occasionally don't get a chance to see because this had a conflicting screening. I had to go see another movie at the same time that I'd already previously committed to. So I didn't see Girls Trip, but not for the lack of the studio trying. And I think that's important to note because so often I come on the air and say this movie wasn't screened, so it's probably garbage. I can't give a rating for Girls Trip because I didn't see it, but they tried to show it to us. And I give them credit for it. So, you know, I'm not going to be given a final rating for this one, but let's talk real quickly about it. This one is, it's main essentially aiming for the African-American female audience. It's got Jada Pinkett Smith and Queen Latifah and Regina Hall, who are all playing these women on this, I say girls, but they're women, they're in their 40s. They're on this weekend getaway in this sort of this raucous comedy. And it's directed by the guy who did The Best Man and The Best Man Holiday. And from what I've heard and what you can tell from the trailers, it has those ups and downs. It has that raucous, broad comedy, no pun intended, a broad comedy. But it also has these heavier character moments where they're dealing with relationships and issues there. And those are, I thought in the Best Man movies, those were a little bit trite, but they certainly work for the audience it's going to. This is very much directed as a demographic movie, and I think it's going to do very well in its demographic. It looks funny for what it is. I just didn't get a chance to see it. So I can't give it a review, but I did want to give a little bit of a note for Girls Trip. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the new Doctor Who, the weekly box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Kong Skull Island. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about a piece of news that happened this weekend. And I didn't do this in the news segment because I had to talk about George Romero and Martin Landau. But this is something that was big. And I talked about this last week right before they announced it. And that is the new Doctor Who. Now, I remember talking last week, I was saying who I'd like. I mean, I always was saying I liked Richard Iotti from the IT crowd. I think he's fantastic. He would have been a great doctor. And I've learned with Doctor Who not to say I like or don't like a doctor until I actually see them. Because I didn't know anything about Matt Smith, and I thought he looked goofy as all get up, but I thought he was a fantastic doctor. And in retrospect, I remember back when I heard they were doing Christopher Eccleston as the new Doctor Who, I was all excited, but then I saw him and I really wasn't wild about his version of Doctor Who. We already knew that Peter Capaldi's character was going to regenerate and that he was done with the series. And they're like, oh, we're going to announce the new Doctor Who after the Wimbledon finals for men. And everyone was all excited. I think had more people watching Wimbledon because they were excited about Doctor Who than actually caring about the tennis match. And like, even like David Tennant shown up. And of course, David Tennant was the 10th doctor and was one of the most beloved of the new doctors. But him and Matt Smith are probably the most liked. And there's kind of a, you know, Elvis and Beatles argument. And of course, there was all this speculation. Are we going to have a female doctor? And the reason that was speculated is because they've teased that. They actually teased that way back when Matt Smith regenerated into Peter Capaldi. And that was a big discussion several years ago when that happened. And they've set the stage over the last several years with Peter Capaldi's episodes to say, yes, we have determined that a Time Lord can regenerate and change genders. And they announced that Jodie Whittaker from Broadchurch, ironically playing in a show with David Tennant, she is going to be the new doctor. And this will be the first female doctor. And that's great. I mean, I remember seeing Jodie Whittaker in Attack the Block. I thought she was fine. I thought she had a real sort of Emily Mortimer quality to her. But I mean, she wasn't the crux of that movie. John Boyega was the big one in that movie. And of course, the aliens. And she was, a secondary role really in that. But I don't have anything against her. I'm looking forward to it because it's the first Doctor Who I kind of want to smash. To use a Trevor Noah term. I sound terrible using that term. Oh my God. I never do that again, Kevin. That's awful. Anyways, this is why historical context, why it works. People have said they're retconning it to make him be able to regenerate. You do realize that the regeneration of Doctor Who was a retcon in the first place. Way back in the 60s, when William Hartnell stopped doing it and they moved to the second doctor, they're like, well, let's keep the character. Let's make this make, they can regenerate. Let's just make that up. That in itself was made to continue the series. They then suddenly had this thing where they said you can only regenerate 12 or 13 times. And they kind of reached that level with Matt Smith. And then they retconned again and said, okay, we're going to have the Time Lords from Gallifrey give him these special powers. So he apparently has unlimited regeneration energy now. So retconning the gender swap, yeah, that's not the way it was originally conceived, but this entire series over the last 50 some years has been about changing things with as things ebb and flow in the world. So I'm totally fine with that. If she's good, great. If she's not, I'm just looking for a good doctor. I don't care what her genitals are. But, well, I kind of do because, you know, like I said, I want to smash. But what was so frustrating is I remember watching the announcement and immediately people are like going, male tears. Oh, big man baby are butthurt because of this. And I saw nonstop tweeting about that. And I searched the hashtags Doctor Who 13, Doctor 13, BBC, all those things. I found almost, I don't think I, maybe I saw one comment complaining about a female doctor. Everyone else was on board. And I'm sure there are people out there who do, and I've been told by other people I know who are friends with other fans that they have heard people complain about, oh, you know, a doctor's not going to be able to park the TARDIS, and, you know, is it Nurse Who? Which, I mean, like, really, it's 2017. Are we still going with the whole thing that doctors are men and nurses are, is that the joke still? I mean, that joke's older than most people making the joke. This is the essence of Twitter nowadays, where people are suddenly going, oh, all you sexists, shut up. You can find any abhorrent belief and any abhorrent statement on the internet. Just because you can find it does not mean you need to give it a spotlight and make it sound like it's mainstream. I really don't think there's that many people complaining about that. I really don't think there are that many people upset that it's a female doctor. I'm sure there are, but it's sort of like when Mad Max came out, Fury Road. There weren't a whole, I really don't think there are that many men out there that were upset that it had such a female-centric plot and characters. I thought it was a legitimate complaint to say Mad Max's character was secondary at best. Look, people, just pump the brakes. Enjoy the winning your female doctor instead of having to rub it in the male tears butthurt man-baby child that doesn't exist. Don't be a jerk about it. Just enjoy it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about the box office. Last week I said $65 million for Planet of the Apes. A little bit soft on that. It didn't do as well. I'm not hugely surprised by that simply because it's not a broad, crowd-pleasing movie. $56 million is what it made. That's perfectly fine, especially because internationally I think it's going to do plenty. But that's what I expected, and that's actually really good for a cerebral movie in which very little dialogue happens outside of ape sign languaging to each other. And then, of course, Spider-Man Homecoming came in with 44. That was quite a bit of a drop, but I think it's just people aren't treating it like an original movie. They're treating it like another Marvel movie, and it's dropping like that. And Wonder Woman suffered less of a drop because there was something new with Wonder Woman, being that it was a Wonder Woman movie. We've had how many Spider-Man movies in the last 15 years? This week, I think Dunkirk's going to win. I think it's going to have an inflated box office, mainly because of the 70mm and the IMAX bump. There's going to be a lot of people seeing it in that format, so there's going to be fewer people seeing it, but a higher number. But I still think it's right around 40 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Spotlight this week is on Kong Skull Island, which is one of my favorite movies of the year. Honestly, it's a better war film than Dunkirk, as is War of the Planet of the Apes. You know, what's funny is the movies that I like the most this year are about CGI apes. I don't know why. But before I start talking about it, let's play the trailer. Kong Skull Island. At the end of the Vietnam War, a team of scientists and a military escort travel to a mysterious island populated with monsters.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet. I see
trouble on the way. Is that a monkey?
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your men, Colonel. But if you want to make their sacrifice worthwhile, hit us home with proof.
If you didn't see it in the theaters, it's really, really good, mainly because it does what science fiction can do, which is telling a story through a different lens. This deconstructs the American experience coming out of Vietnam and the emotional turmoil that a lot of people had. And in a lot of ways, this is Apocalypse Now with a giant ape in it. And it's also something different in terms of Kong. It's not just a rehash of the old story, not bringing him back to America and having him climb the Empire State Building again. It's something wholly different, which is awesome and fantastic. and deconstructing the human condition and the American experience following the first war that we didn't win. Now, there's also a lot of good stuff on the Blu-ray. There's about 5 or 6 minutes of deleted scenes. There's also a commentary, and you don't always get commentaries as much. They're not as common, but you get a commentary, which is fantastic because it has the director looking at this, and he has a lot to say about the movie, and he can break down what's going on. You also have a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff. You have looking at how they were going to create Kong and how they were using the special effects and how they're bringing the different characters together and how they developed the Kong look, which isn't exactly a gorilla. It also examines looking at shooting in Vietnam 40 years after we left there. More interesting, though, aside from a little bit of, you know, sort of ego-driven spotlights on the actors, there's Monarch Files, which are the fake agency behind the movie. And it's their secret files about Kong and Skull Island. And it's 7 or 8 minutes, but those are fun to watch because they're sort of in context, special features. So overall, Kong Skull Island is a great movie. Totally worth seeing if you haven't seen it. And I'm going to have to say it and the Blu-ray totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Other movies that are out this week on DVD and Blu-ray are The Promise, which is, of course, about the Armenian Genocide, Free Fire, which was Ben Wheatley's latest movie, and The Expanse Season 2. That is it. I need to go for the week. Next week when I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Emoji Movie and Atomic Blonde. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.